We were starting
And by
to
my
break up.
clock, yeah, by my clock here, I've got it being 1:30. I'd like to welcome everyone to another Weber training teleclass. My name is Jim Gauthier. I'm an infection control practitioner at Providence Care in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Gardam, who will be presenting a presentation entitled Controlling Clostridium difficile Outbreaks, Going Beyond the Guidelines. And this presentation today is sponsored by Virox Technologies. I'll do a little bio on Dr. Gardam. Dr. Gardam is the Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University Health Network in Toronto, Ontario, and he's the Director of the Tuberculosis Clinic at Toronto Western Hospital. Dr. Gardam is a colorful speaker. He is in constant demand to speak at international conferences and seminars. And Dr. Gardam definitely has a talent for taking complicated medical theories and terminologies and converting them into everyday, clear terms. He's always at the forefront of change within the medical community. He's a Canadian pioneer in the use of the behavioral change technique of positive deviance and speaks internationally on this subject. Dr. Gardam was trained at McGill University in Montreal and went on to get an additional subspecialty training in infectious disease. He completed a Master's of Science in Health Administration and is Assistant Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Gardam and I have shared the podium many times together. I think he's glad that he's actually going first and not having to follow me doing anything like tap dancing or otherwise. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Gardam.
Thanks very much, Jim. And thanks very much to Weber Training for inviting me to speak on this topic today. And I'm going to walk you through my slides as I change them here myself. So moving on to the first slide about objectives. I'm going to be briefly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the recommended measures for controlling C. difficile. I'll spend most of my time talking about how we've dealt with outbreaks here in Ontario and give you some of the background of the systems we have in place to deal with that. And try to address some of the controversies, because there are quite a few controversies in infection control as it relates to C. diff, and really try to work through some of those. So going on to my outline, we'll talk briefly about C. diff 101. And I often don't get into too much of the basics about C. diff for an audience such as this, but I've recently had some experience where people that I really thought knew more about C. diff than they did sort of asked questions and made me realize that it's probably a good idea to kind of go through some of the very basic stuff just to make sure that we all understand sort of C. diff colonization and disease and that sort of thing. I'll talk about two guidelines. I'll talk about the Shea guidelines because they're big guidelines. They're very well referenced. And they're brand new. And I'll talk about the Ontario Provincial Infectious Diseases Advisory Committee guidelines on C. difficile, which are much shorter than the Shea ones. And by and large, they say pretty much the same thing, but I will go through those. And then I'll go through what we've been doing with C. difficile here in Ontario. I'll talk about our infection control resource teams, where they came from, and what they've been able to do, and also get into a lot about what we found when we've gone into a variety of organizations and, you know, some of the common themes where we've been able to help them get their C. difficile under control. So moving on to the next slide. So this is just the idea that with C. difficile, there really are two hits that are kind of required for the vast majority of people to actually develop disease. So the first hit is, well, you can't get C. difficile if you don't actually have it in your gut. So the first thing that has to happen is you have to be colonized with a toxin-producing strain of C. difficile. And you can acquire that in different places. I'll talk about it in a second, but probably the majority of places that people catch this is in the hospital setting, but certainly there is growing evidence that you can catch this in the community as well. You don't have to be hospitalized to be exposed potentially to C. difficile. And there are certainly studies out there now showing that toxigenic strains are in the food chain. The spores are not killed by cooking. So, you know, we may be seeing more and more people getting colonized with this outside of the healthcare setting. But roughly speaking, the estimate is that probably 3/4 of cases that you see in a hospital picked it up in that hospital. The second step that sort of has to happen is you have to kind of turn the C. difficile on so that it starts to produce toxin. And that typically occurs through the receipt of antibiotics, which are killing off other flora in the gut. and allowing the C. difficile to start to grow and start to produce toxin and then potentially make the person sick. Not everybody who gets C. difficile disease actually received antibiotics, but the vast majority of people do. There's also some other questions out there surrounding proton pump inhibitors. There still seems to be a moderate amount of debate around that, with some studies showing that they have a big impact as well, and others showing that they don't. So I've sort of left proton pump inhibitors out there, but I will say that some places in controlling their C. diff do try to control PPIs, and others don't. It's sort of all over the map right now. But the big thing is antibiotics. The other thing that potentially can cause this in some people is actually receipt of chemotherapy agents, because chemotherapy agents often are quite similar to antibiotics in that they kill cells and they can be killing off gut flora in addition to cancer cells, in addition to other cells, and sometimes that can also predispose to developing disease if you're colonized with C. diff. So go on to the next slide. So, as I said, the majority is believed to be healthcare associated, probably about three quarters of it people pick up in the hospital. And there's been a number of studies done on this where they've actually sequentially cultured C. difficile from patients when they come into the hospital, and then a week later, and then 2 weeks later, et cetera. And, you know, just sort of combining these studies into a couple bullet points, one study showed that up to over half of patients, of inpatients in one site, get colonized after 4 weeks. Now, that's one site. That's not everybody in Canada or everybody in the U.S., so you can't necessarily throw that 50% number around and say that's, you know, written in stone. But you can certainly throw around the idea that C. diff spreads pretty nicely in the healthcare setting, and a lot more people are colonized with it than actually get sick with it. There was a recent Irish study looking at long-term care where they found that 10% of nursing home residents were asymptomatically colonized with C. diff, and 70% of these were actually toxin-producing strains. So again, it's out there, and there's a lot of people who are carrying this around in their gut, and these numbers are much higher than were quoted, you know, 20, 30 years ago when people first started doing studies like this. So there's more of it out there, and more people seem to be being colonized with it. Go on to the next slide. So as I mentioned, one study showed that 85% of hospitalized cases had received antibiotics within 4 weeks of the disease. And, you know, the receipt of more antibiotics, like more types of drugs, more doses of antibiotics, longer treatment duration are all independently associated with developing C. difficile disease. And, you know, one of our biggest challenges in infection control is that the literature supporting a lot of the control measures that we use, when you compare it to other areas of medicine, such as cardiology or, you know, other, you know, cancer chemotherapy, et cetera, we don't tend to do the randomized controlled trial thing. It's very hard for us to do that. The literature that we have supporting our interventions isn't great, but probably the best evidence we have for C. difficile control, for what it's worth, is actually controlling antibiotics. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, getting rid of the higher risk drugs. And classically, the higher risk drugs are things like clindamycin and third generation cephalosporins, and more recently, fluoroquinolones. It's not just a matter of replacing those, but also just overall giving fewer prescriptions of antibiotics. Because there's no antibiotic out there, I mean, besides perhaps, you know, oral vancomycin and Flagyl, there really aren't many antibiotics out there that can't cause C. diff. So you can focus on the high risk ones, but if you're still using a lot of first-generation cephalosporins and other drugs, you may still have a fair amount of C. diff happening, because you really need to control all antibiotic use. I can tell you anecdotally that as an infectious diseases physician, you know, probably at least 50% of the people we see on the consult service, it's questionable whether they need those antibiotics. We tend to spend a lot of our time stopping antibiotics and limiting the duration of treatment. I mean, I'm sure many of you who work in acute care realize people can end up on antibiotics for weeks without clear reasons why. And, you know, you can sort of understand where that thinking comes from, because we've all been sort of sold the bill of goods that antibiotics are benign interventions and you just sort of want to cover your ass, so why don't we give you some antibiotics and then we'll be good. The concern with that, of course, is that, you know, as we learn more and more about C. difficile, is that they're not benign interventions. And, you know, people die from C. difficile, and I have no doubt that some people have developed C. difficile and died from it as a result of antibiotics that they received that they did not need. So these are not, this is no longer, should we consider antibiotics a truly benign intervention. So this is a big control measure that I'll talk about later on. It's also probably the hardest control measure to pull off. Going on to the next slide. So I've summarized a 50 or 60 page Shea document in about three slides here, but I think I get the gist of it. The first one's kind of obvious. You don't know you've got a problem unless you're looking for it. So they talk about doing surveillance, and they spend a lot of time talking about what's the best case definition to use. Personally, those of you who have worked with me before know that I don't care what case definition you use as long as it's somewhat rational and you stick to it. We can spend our lives in infection control trying to perfect the perfect case definition, but who gives a damn if as long as it's measuring more or less what you want to look at. So doing surveillance is definitely important, keeping line lists of every case of C. difficile, tracking what units it's on, whether you're having clusters, et cetera. I think that one is pretty self-evident. The testing, only testing people with symptoms, is an obvious one, but we've recently had some experience here at UHN where it sort of shows that it can sometimes be difficult to do that. And I'll explain that in just a couple seconds. The other comment they make about testing is that the enzyme immunoassay doesn't work well. The gold standard is still sort of a cytotoxic culture, but that PCR also holds promise. And we recently switched to PCR here at UHN about 2 months ago. And the sensitivity of the EIA is about 60%. And I'm sure those of you that have used that test know that if it's negative the first time, you might do it again, and you may even do it a third time. But it's not a great test to actually pick up cases of C. difficile disease. PCR is far more sensitive. So what we've identified is our rates of C. difficile doubled as soon as we switched from EIA to PCR, which, you know, is a good thing in a way because it means you're picking up more cases so you can control it better, so maybe your rates will start to go down. But one of the things we started identifying is that, you know, many of those so-called cases had a C. difficile sent for questionable reasons. And what I mean by that is, let's say you've got a patient on medicine who's got some chronic constipation, they're given some laxatives, they have one or two bouts of loose stool, which you can really adequately say is due to getting the laxatives. But for whatever reason, a C. difficile is sent and it's positive. Well, what do you do with that person? I mean, maybe they've had three loose stools within 24 hours, which is sort of a fairly common definition of diarrhea, but you have another cause for it. And if they don't have abdominal pain and they don't have a white count and the diarrhea stops as soon as you stop the laxatives, is this really C. difficile or is this more colonization? And that's the challenge we're getting into. And whereas with the EIA, we were quite happy to call any positive a real positive, with PCR, we're becoming a little bit more selective and making sure we're sort of reviewing every case and making sure that this is actually real, because we don't want to be overcalling our C. difficile rate as well. So the testing one is an interesting one that will evolve over time. In terms of their infection control measures, gowns, gloves, single rooms, we all know about that, is recommended. Cohorting only if necessary, and if you do cohort, you're sort of providing people with their own commodes. Shea comes out pretty clearly emphasizing soap and water over alcohol-based hand rub for hand hygiene, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit later because I have some big issues with that. So I'll jump on to the next slide here. IPAC measures, you're continuing contact precautions until diarrhea abates. There are certainly studies out there that show up to 7 days after diarrhea has abated, the person can still be heavily colonized with C. difficile. What do you do with that? Can you really isolate people forever until they leave the hospital? I mean, most of us don't have enough single rooms to do that. So at some point, if their diarrhea is finished, you do need to potentially stop their contact precautions. However, realize that they still may have environmental contamination with C. difficile, and so take that into account when you're talking about hand hygiene and you're talking about cleaning the environment. They don't recommend routine surveillance for colonized individuals. There's been several studies on this looking at it, and by and large, you can identify these people, but it's not necessarily clear what you do with them. They have done some studies where they've tried giving them Flagyl, which doesn't seem to eradicate the C. difficile carriage when they're not sick. And others have given vancomycin, which does seem to eradicate carriage at least intermittently, but then it tends to come back again. So what do you do with these people? But again, it does give you the idea that there's potentially quite a few people in your facility that may be shedding C. difficile but not actually having symptoms. The cleaning and disinfection guidelines, I mean, they're talking about trying to get away from a lot of this multi-use equipment and moving more towards dedicated equipment. The obvious reason for that is because we all suck at cleaning multi-use equipment. I've yet to go to an organization that's totally nailed that one down where everybody knows who's supposed to clean the commode. Every place, and this includes my own, you get these vacant stares of, well, I thought it was so-and-so. All I know is that it's not infection control that cleans these things. That I know for pretty sure. They talk about using sporicidal agents if your rates are actually increasing. And this is a vague thing. So if you think you've got a problem, they typically say talk to infection control and you should use sporicidal agents. But it's vague, like how often, where, on what surfaces. And that's stuff that we've had a lot of experience with in Ontario that I'll talk about in a few minutes. In general, they don't recommend environmental screening. We really don't recommend environmental screening for most things because you know what, you're going to find it. So, and if you don't find it, it doesn't mean it's not there. So save your swabs and, you know, use them for something else. So going on to the next slide, antibiotics. I've already talked about this. They say implement antimicrobial stewardship. That statement's kind of similar to saying we should have world peace. It's a great idea and it works very well. It can be remarkably challenging. I've only really known one hospital that has pulled this off extremely well. Most places have a real hard time with it because it involves physician behavior, and that's not an easy thing to change. Probiotics, Shea's come out and said don't recommend them. There are, again, conflicting studies with probiotics, some saying that if you give them prophylactically, they seem to have a benefit, others saying that they don't seem to, and the world is sort of sitting on the fence. In terms of treatment, Shea comes out saying you should initiate empiric therapy, stop antibiotics, and then the treatment's there. For first-time disease that's relatively mild, you would use Flagyl. If it's more serious, you would use vancomycin. And if they relapse, you tend to go straight to vancomycin at higher doses. So going on to the next slide, consider colectomy for severe disease, toxic megacolon, and I mentioned the other two. So that's sort of an overview of the Shea document. And what I plan to do when I talk about our experience in Ontario is go through what's been happening with all these guidelines. What have people really been doing? Where have been the big gaps in terms of what we've seen? So in terms of the PIDAC guidelines, for those of you from Ontario or who have seen PIDAC documents, there aren't huge, there's no real major controversy between Shea and PIDAC. PIDAC has very detailed environmental cleaning disinfection guidelines that are referred to in the C. diff document, and they also outline what we actually have to report here in Ontario to the province. For those of you not from Ontario, we are required publicly to report our C. difficile numbers every month, and they go on a Ministry of Health website. So let's talk about infection control resource teams. So what are these? Where did they come from? And, you know, what do they do? So going on to the next slide. So these were created by the Ministry of Health here in Ontario in September 2008. And the reason they were created was pretty simple. We were going to tell hospitals they had to publicly report their rates of C. difficile. So for the first time, every hospital would know what everybody else's rates looked like, and you're going to have some hospitals that look at their rates and go, oh dear, we're higher than everybody else. And the next question out of their mouth is, you know, who can help us with this? Damn you, Ministry of Health, for making this public. Now who's going to help us? So these teams were created to do this, and they are led by senior infection control professionals. There's usually one or more infection control physicians and epidemiologists. The infection control physician piece really means physicians who do infection control. This is not physicians who may be trained in infectious diseases or micro who don't do infection control for a living. These are people who are primarily, that's their main job. There are two teams. When these were created, the government put out a tender for teams to bid on, and there's two teams. One is from the Ottawa Hospital. The other one is here at University Health Network. And our job is really to respond to outbreaks. These were created for C. difficile, but we have gone for other outbreaks as well, because, you know, the kind of thinking is really very, very similar. So moving on to the next slide. So the process is, how do you activate one of these teams? Either the hospital can call our Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion. That's the government agency that actually kind of oversees these. They can call them and say, we want a team. Or they can call public health. And if they call their local public health unit, that goes through a bit of a roundabout way, getting back to the agency. And again, the team can be launched. Sometimes we'll get emailed directly. I'll get an email from a hospital directly, and I will just send it off to the agency to say, you know, what do you want to do with this? We send a pre-visit questionnaire asking, you know, the kind of questions you would expect us to ask. So what kind of hospital do you have? What's your patient population like? What's been happening on your different units? What are your rates of C. diff? How do you clean stuff? What kind of testing do you use? Show us your policies. You know, what have you done thus far? That sort of thing. So that we're not spending, you know, hours getting that background information once we get there. Because we typically visit for a full day, and it's a pretty packed day, so it's often quite tiring, and you don't want to spend two-thirds of it trying to get background information you could have asked for ahead of time. We then write up a written report, which is to be there within 20 business days of the visit. And then we typically do a follow-up questionnaire several months later and ask, you know, how is it going? Some sites have kept very much engaged with us afterwards and have asked even for a second follow-up visit, which sometimes we've done. Others kind of vanish into the woodwork and we never really hear from them again. But we do a follow-up questionnaire. And remember, we can follow their rates publicly because they're all posted. So we can get a sense of what's going on. And on occasion, I have actually emailed the CEO back and said, you know, we haven't talked in a few months, but I see your rates are still high. Do you still want some help from us? So these are meant to be helpful. They're not meant to be punitive. They're not meant to make people feel bad. They're meant to give, you know, a second, third, fourth pair of eyes looking at the problem and try to see if we can come up with some you know, different ideas. I mean, to be very transparent, we had a big problem at our hospital here at UHN over the Christmas holidays from C. difficile, which likely related to the unbelievable number of isolations we had due to influenza here in Toronto. But we actually asked for a team to come visit us because, you know, we wanted to get a sense if they had anything else that they could suggest to us, because sometimes when you're stuck right in the middle of a problem, you may not realize that you've missed something. So, you know, even the hospital that fields the teams can ask for a team to come and help them when they're having issues. So where have we been? These little H's are where we've been in the province. So we've done about 15 or 16 of these, I think, since they were originally invented. So they've certainly been used, and I think they could be used more. There's still a number of places that I look at their rates and think, you know, you could probably use some help. So if people are interested, they can simply contact the Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion, and they can field the team. So as I mentioned earlier, I mean, these are not meant to be punitive, and we don't go in there with a cookie-cutter approach to these things. Guidelines are guidelines, but as all of you who do infection control know, the devil is in the details. So guidelines are helpful in that they tell you what to do, but they don't tell you how to do it. So, you know, writing a sentence like clean multi-use equipment between uses sounds great, but how do you do that in practice? And our place is doing that in practice. Can be really challenging. So we go in and we look at the hospital practices, we benchmark with best practice documents, and we give detailed practice advice, especially in these gray areas, like I mentioned, when do you use sporicidal agents, that sort of thing. We also identify and help the hospital address cultural issues surrounding relationships. And what I mean by that is there's some organizations you walk into and you know very quickly that they're taking this really seriously. They're struggling, but they're taking it very seriously. You sit down and meet with the senior team, and it's pretty clear they know what's going on. They know what C. diff is. They know what their rates are. They can tell you the kind of things they've been doing. And then there's other organizations you go into where the senior team doesn't really know what's going on. And, you know, or when you talk to the infection control team, they really haven't been able to get their message heard to other people, et cetera. So we can help point those things out and help give some suggestions in terms of maybe you want to reorganize who infection control reports to, maybe they need to be on different committees, that sort of thing to help start to tidy those things up a bit. So one of the things we did when we first started this, and these data are about a year old now, so we have to update them. I have to talk to the agency about that one to redo part of the study for the last year. But we basically did a pre-post intervention study comparing hospitals who received ICRT visits to a randomly selected control group of hospitals that didn't have ICRT visits. And we matched them based on hospital type and bed size. We looked at the nosocomial C. difficile infection rate 3 months before and after an ICRT visit or a comparable period for the control hospitals. And the data were collected from the provincial database over that 1.5 year period. This is an example of the kind of thing that we would see. So visiting this hospital where you see that, early on in November 08, they had a high rate of C. difficile. They had done some things and their rate went down. Now, whether their rate goes down because of those things or it's just happenstance, you never know. But we basically visited again in January 09. We gave them the report after that and gave a number of recommendations. And their rate overall dropped, back to kind of where the baseline would be for control hospitals. If we go to the next slide, if we take all of those hospitals that we visited and sort of lump them all together, you can see that, again, the places that had the ICRT visit, they started out very high, but over time, they dropped to pretty much the baseline of hospitals that were similar to them. So I think we can say there is an association between our visits and the rates going down. Whether it's our visits per se, you can't really tell. We haven't randomized teams to infection control, randomized hospitals to infection control teams or not. But I think there is a clear association. And in speaking with the hospitals after the fact, there is a very strong sense that these team visits have been very, very helpful in terms of pointing out different directions to go in. So is there a recipe for successful C. diff control? So at this point of the talk, I'll get into some of the things that we found with this kind of work. So as I said several times, every facility is different. However, there are common themes. Usually infection control has been struggling for 1 or more months trying to control a C. diff without success. Very few organizations have a well-functioning antimicrobial stewardship program. We are seeing more places beginning to develop them, but very few places have actually really been able to pull something off. One of the things that we get greeted with all the time is confusion over whether there's actually an outbreak because the cases are widely dispersed. They're not necessarily on one particular unit. They may have started that way a year ago, but now they're kind of all over the place. And the question comes, how can this really be an outbreak because there's no clear epidemiologic link between all of these cases? Going to the next slide, I think one thing we have to remember is that epi-links with C. diff are rarely as obvious as they are with something like MRSA. Usually you don't have MRSA popping up all over your hospital. Usually you can identify the trail that MRSA follows through the organization. With C. difficile, because it can live in the environment potentially for 6, 12 months, it's a very different animal than MRSA, and we shouldn't expect the epidemiology to look the same. So my word of advice is if you have widely dispersed cases, don't just assume that they're not linked. They may very well be linked. It's just you may not be able to see the link. So on the next slide, I was going to show that. Now, this was a lovely animated slide where those little suns spun, and they walked all around the unit, and I can't show you any of that, so it's really too bad. But if you look at the top left-hand corner, let's say there's a patient up there with that sun who develops C. difficile, and that patient or their bed or some equipment or dirty hands, whatever it is, gets C. difficile to the patient beside them. You can then imagine that if that, let's say the mop or whatever that was used to clean that room or let's say the brush that was used to clean that toilet ends up making its way to all the way over to the other side of the unit and then cleans a toilet there and then it gets spread, you can see how C. difficile can easily spread around the unit. But because people can be colonized with it but not develop illness for a while, especially if they're not on antibiotics, and because it can live in the environment for so long, those epilinks get lost over time. This is not like influenza where it's bam, 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 and you can see it spread. The epilinks are there, but they're lost. You just can't see them anymore. And so over time, because C. diff lives in the environment of spores, you can imagine every room at some point, let's say you have a unit that has a lot of C. diff, you can imagine every room has some C. difficile spores in it. And so that's the epilink. The epilink is your building is contaminated rather than a particular room is contaminated. So I'll move on to the next slide here. So one of the things that we've identified with culture is, in general, rates begin to improve once the outbreak has the clear, undivided attention of senior administration. Often it's our visit that makes that happen. Sometimes it was happening before we got there, but sometimes it's our visit that helps that happen. And what I mean by this is everybody's speaking the same language, that getting rid of C. diff is our priority. They mean it. They're showing up at the meetings that have been booked about this. They typically have some sort of task force that has been developed where people are coming in. They are reporting back the rates daily. Like, this is a real thing. They're taking it very seriously. Organizations that have kind of been phoning it in, like, you know, we just want infection control to deal with this and not to have the whole organization kind of focused on it, they have tended to really struggle. So that senior leadership piece is absolutely key, kind of because it gives permission to people to really focus on this because they have lots of other, you know, competing priorities. But if your CEO is constantly saying we have to get rid of C. difficile, you will tend to do that. In places where senior admin has really taken the leadership, IPAC moves to more of an advisory role. They're not fighting with people anymore because they don't need to. Somebody else is doing that. They're there giving advice on how often should we clean, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's been pretty universal. Physicians are not engaged to the degree we would like. I've certainly been to some organizations where physicians have been more engaged than others, but as a group, we don't tend to pay attention to this stuff. And so that is not something that one organization is going to, you know, be able to fix. But it really does drive home the point again that physicians have a great deal of power in healthcare, and we send a very strong message that something is not important if we don't pay attention to it. I'll move on to the next slide. So this makes epidemiologists go crazy when I show slides like this. But the basic idea is that a hospital has increasing C. difficile rates, they take charge, they do a whole whack of stuff, and their C. diff rates go down. Very, you know, you're not going to see a hospital that has high rates of C. difficile, maybe with some, you know, some bad outcomes, patients dying, et cetera, who are just going to say, we're going to implement gloves and study that for 6 months. You know, nobody does that. We do the sort of shotgun approach. And so you can't really come out, and that also includes papers, by the way, because you can have an organization that publishes on how they approached a C. difficile outbreak, but you know what? That works for them in their context. There may be some generalities that you can use for your context. However, the fact remains it's the combination of everything that you did, and you can't really say what's more important, one or the other. It's everything that you did that brought about those decreased rates. And I think we just have to accept that that's the fact. We cannot study this the way that we study other things in medicine. Go on to the next slide. So surveillance and testing, what are some of the things that we found? We found things were worse early on than they are now. Now it would be unusual for us to go into an organization and find out that they weren't adequately finding cases. Early on, when we first started this work, though, which might have been, you know, 5-6 years ago, that was just when C. difficile was changing from a sort of an annoying thing to a very serious thing. The NAP1 strain was just starting to spread in Ontario, and it caught hospitals unaware. It caught physicians unaware. So early on, what we found was that people weren't necessarily testing cases, or if they were testing cases, the results were taking up to a week to come back, depending on how often the lab was doing them and where the results were put in the chart and how quickly the physician was being notified and whether the physician did something about it. Also, there were often delays in actually isolating patients before you even had the results back. So there was a general sense that, you know, C. diff early on wasn't being taken seriously. That's changed, and as I said, it's unusual to see that now, but it's always something we look for to make sure that people who get unexplained diarrhea on a particular unit where you're thinking C. difficile is a possibility, they should be put in isolation and contact precautions immediately while waiting for the results. The EIA test is still by far the most commonly test used, and it has all of those problems associated with it that a negative test does not rule out disease, you may have to do it again, et cetera. And as I mentioned in the beginning, switching to PCR is wonderful because you're not getting those false negatives, but now you're getting a whack of positives, not all of which necessarily mean that the person actually has active disease with C. difficile. What do we do with those people, by the way? We just talked about that this morning in our team meeting. The fact remains, though, is that if somebody had diarrhea, got tested for C. diff, and let's say the diarrhea was due to a laxative because it stopped as soon as you stopped the laxatives, they still, if they're positive for C. diff, they still have toxin-producing strains in their gut, and, you know, they could still spread it. So we've identified them. What we've decided to do here is we will put them in contact precautions to follow our policies. If after 48 hours they continue not to have diarrhea, then we will then take them out again. We have not used whether the physician is treating them or not as an indication as to whether they've got disease or not, because everybody's getting treated. We're all very paranoid about NAP1 C. difficile, so no one feels comfortable leaving a positive test untreated, even if the person never develops diarrhea again and doesn't have a white count or anything else. So that's sort of how we've been dealing with that here. The IPAC practices, as I sort of hinted at in the beginning, there's very little evidence to support any one practice. No hospital has studied just using gowns or just gloves or just single rooms or cohorting, et cetera. We do them all at once. There is overwhelming practical, theoretical reasons why this should work, because this stuff is being spread patient to patient through the environment, on your hands, et cetera. So there's ample, I think, you know, pragmatic reasons why you would do this. It does, however, lead to pushback because people will say, you know, often it's physicians asking you, you know, what's the evidence that this is working? But I think the point is that it's not surprising that we can't study these things well. And I think we need to kind of get over that and we just have to use them because it makes very good practical sense why you would do this. And as a group, as a bundle, this along with other stuff has been shown over and over again to actually bring about decreased rates. So going on to the next slide. So contact precautions, you know, gowns and gloves are standard. Many hospitals in Ontario have had serious issues with single rooms because they don't have any. And so there has been a fair amount of cohorting. We're not crazy about cohorting, of course, because people can get reinfected with C. diff. So you could have two patients in the room who are busy giving C. diff back and forth to each other, and so it can sort of prolong your problem. But if you don't have a choice, you don't have a choice. We have, in general, not recommended C. difficile wards where you try to, you know, congregate all of your patients in the hospital on those units, partially because you'll still get cases popping up outside of those wards, and you may run out of beds, and you really haven't necessarily changed very much. And then there are still asymptomatically colonized. Remember in the beginning I said up to half of patients can be colonized with C. diff. They're contaminating their environment as well, albeit not nearly as much as patients who have rip-roaring diarrhea. But it's not really solving your problem so much. You can't put them all in that ward and say there is not a scrap of C. difficile off this ward, because there still is C. difficile going on elsewhere. Moving on to the next slide. This is one of the big controversies. Soap and water versus alcohol-based hand rub, and which one should you be using for C. difficile? So for those of you who haven't heard this controversy, the gist is that alcohol gel does not kill C. difficile spores. In fact, it tends to help create C. difficile spores. So it's really not, there is theoretical evidence why if using it for hand washing, you may actually be not getting rid of the C. diff off your hands. So this has been batted about back and forth for quite a while. And there was a good paper in Itchy that came out earlier this year that actually talked specifically about this. And these two people were actually on the Shea guidelines as well. And you remember the Shea guidelines say use soap and water. But these authors make these comments. For soap and water to be better than hand rub, then you must be able to reliably identify who is shedding C. difficile, right? Because what you're saying is soap and water for C. diff patients, alcohol-based hand rub for everybody else. Well, from what I've told you, you know that's not true, because up to 1 in 2 patients actually are shedding C. difficile in your organization. So that doesn't work so well. The big one in my mind is using soap and water must not decrease hand hygiene compliance. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, work in organizations where at least some of your clinical care is occurring in places that have no sinks, or they have one sink that's hidden away a bunch, you know, behind a whole bunch of junk or something that nobody can get to. If you actually insist on soap and water hand washing, your compliance with hand washing will drop precipitously. It has to. The main reason why alcohol gel has been, you know, supported by every major organization for hand hygiene, one of the main reasons is because people use it. They don't tend to use soap and water. So I know of some organizations that have gone out and actually bought portable sinks to try to help with hand hygiene, but in general, as I'll mention in a few seconds, we have not pushed soap and water at all. Finally, the comment that these authors make is that in vitro studies must be meaningful in the real world. And what they mean by that is when they do these studies, they have typically put many fold more spores on your hands in order to show a significant difference with soap or with gel than actually get on your hands when you touch somebody who has C. difficile. So they make the problem look much bigger than it probably is in real life. So that's sort of, you know, one of the main things. The second thing is once you identify somebody with C. difficile, we're taking all those other precautions. You're wearing gowns and gloves, and you're taking those gloves off. And at the end of the day, you know, maybe there's very few spores on your hands anyway. So I'll move on to the next slide. I mean, and there are several studies that have been done. And again, they're from an epidemiologic perspective, they're not great, not at any fault of the researchers, but because it's very hard to do this kind of work, where they've shown they had a rate of C. difficile, they brought in alcohol hand gel, and their rates didn't go up. Therefore, alcohol hand gel may not cause, you know, worse C. difficile. There's also some studies showing that alcohol hand gel was brought in and the rates did go up. That's meaningless. You can't talk about causality in either of those two studies, given all the ways that C. difficile spreads, only one of which is actually hand hygiene. So our advice to hospitals has been use hand gel, put up more hand gel, don't go nutty over the whole soap and water thing. If your hands are grossly contaminated, then obviously use soap and water, but by and large, we've focused on hand gel. And it's worked. We have not had any significant issues where we really started to believe that the soap and water thing was actually meaningful. I think pushing soap and water can actually be harmful by decreasing hand hygiene compliance so much. This is a picture of the old ICU at Toronto Western Hospital. And, like, you know, hand hygiene is only one of your problems in a setting like this. I mean, oh my God, if one of these patients in one of these rooms has C. difficile, you can imagine how hard it is going to be to get rid of it from the environment. So there was a paper that came out again this year in AJIC that talked about, you know, for a pathogen to be really good at spreading through environmental transmission, it has to do all these things. It has to survive for a long time on environmental surfaces. You know, bingo, C. difficile can do that potentially for years. It has to remain virulent after environmental exposure, bingo again, you know, as opposed to something like HIV, which dies when it's in the environment very quickly. It has to be able to contaminate the environment, bingo. Ability to colonize patients, yup. Ability to colonize healthcare workers, hands, yup. Transmission via the hands, yup. Small inoculating dose, yup. Resistance to disinfectants, yup. So you get a setting like the previous slide where you've got so much, such a busy contaminated room, you know, the environment has to play a major role in the ongoing spread of all of this. So what we found when we visited sites is that very few of them have been as aggressive as we wanted them to be with sporicidal agents. So the best practice documents kind of say you may want to use them, but don't really tell you when to use them. They've had a lot of concerns about melting their pieces of equipment and safety concerns. There's been universal confusion over who cleans multi-use equipment, and there's a frequent lack of commodes, bedpans, dedicated equipment, so they can't guarantee you that, you know, these things are being dedicated to C. difficile rooms. going on to the next slide. If you look at this picture from Wordle here, what you see is that the point I wanted to make here is that there are so many things that can be contaminated that could act as the fomite spreading, either a fomite or an environmental source spreading C. difficile from one patient to the other, that there is no one thing you can fix that's going to make it all go away. You kind of have to do the shock and awe, treat all of this as contaminated, and systematically work through it and try to decrease the amount of contamination in these various settings. So we use sporicidal agents widely, and there are several available now. Different sites seem to use different ones. Some of them use the ones based on sodium hypochlorite. Some of them use the ones based on accelerated hydrogen peroxide. I've heard anecdotes from hospitals in the UK where they liked using bleach, for example, because culturally it just smelled clean and people liked that. I've had other places where using bleach, I've been told that staff don't like it because of potential, you know, off-gassing and things like that. So figure out which one works for you. Make sure it kills spores and use it. We've been recommending twice-daily cleaning and disinfection of washrooms and rooms of C. difficile patients. So again, that's with sporicidal agents. If you've got a unit where you think you've got a problem, we use it in all patient rooms, in all washrooms, twice a day, and we use it on the multi-use equipment as well. So basically, we treat that unit as a one gigantic C. difficile room. And we do that for a while. Now, how long that a while might be, it might be a week, it might be 3 or 4 weeks, depending on what we're seeing with the epidemiology. We tell the hospital they have to figure out who cleans what. And I think even after we've done this, it still isn't sorted out. This is going to be going on forever, who people are arguing over who cleans what. We try to get them to dedicate equipment, and we try to get rid of uncleanable items. There was one organization we worked with early on that had old non-wipeable bedside chairs in patient rooms, and we actually recommended that they all be thrown out. They couldn't be cleaned, and God knows how much stuff was going to be in them. You could argue you could steam clean them twice a day, but, you know, who has the time to be able to do that? Antibiotic stewardship, we've identified that, you know, this is really important. It's the right thing to do. It's going to save you money and all those things, but it is hard to do. So we do tell hospitals to go in this direction, and we do give them sometimes names of organizations that seem to have been able to pull it off to see if they can maybe get some advice on doing that work. Probiotics, we have not made recommendations. Some hospitals have used them extensively. Others haven't used them at all. I don't feel strongly either way. If people want to use them, they can go ahead and do that. Patient treatment, early on we found a reluctance to start empiric treatment. We see a lot of dose confusion, people not knowing what doses of flagyl and vancomycin to use. We often see reluctance to use vancomycin with those more serious cases, and similarly a reluctance to get surgical consultation for severe cases and to perform colectomies. It's just almost like there's this medical sense that we don't want to believe this is as bad as it really is. And so some of our work is to help tell them that, in fact, this is serious and they do need to consider doing these things. We've seen a lot of interest across the country, actually, in fecal transplantation. Why differences in availability and approach? There's some hospitals where this is allowed. There's others where it's not allowed. Each place seems to be doing its own thing in terms of what recipe it's using for doing this. Some places are actually doing it at home. Some places may be doing it in hotels. And some of this is what prompted the trial that's going on here, being led by Susie Hoda at UHN, which is actually an RCT comparing fecal transplant and vancomycin taper. We need to get to the bottom of this. The anecdotal evidence is that this works extremely well. We need to have fewer case series and more of these more randomized controlled trials that are ethics approved that actually will really get to the bottom of how well this works. Go on to the next slide. So in summary, places that have really been able to pull this off have a single common focus on the problem, and they get into the details. The leadership team gets into the details. There's a cultural shift where it's made clear to everybody that they own this. You can't blame infection control for C. difficile. You have to. Everybody owns it. Enhanced environmental cleaning is a big one where we use sporicidal agents widely, and we use them for a long time. We have not had any significant staff complaints or patient complaints despite using these directly in patient rooms. at least not with accelerated hydrogen peroxide. I think with bleach there have been some issues with off-gassing and things. We've pushed in hand hygiene, and we've focused on alcohol gel, not soap and water. And we are pushing antibiotic stewardship and realize that this is obviously a difficult thing to do. And so at this point, I will go back to you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gardam. It was a very timely presentation, at least for myself here. You mentioned vancomycin tapering. I'm just wondering if you could expand on that just a bit.
It's kind of a weird concept because nobody ever tapers antibiotics, but the idea is that you basically taper the vancomycin down over a six-week period. So you start them at sort of 500 QID, and then every week or 2 weeks you are slowly dropping that dose down so they're getting less and less, and you're observing them for relapses. And for whatever reason, I mean, this has been studied a couple times now, it seems to work reasonably well. It seems to work better than just treating them and then stopping suddenly. So you can try treating them and stopping suddenly the first time around, maybe the second time around, but if it comes back now a third time, you then tend to taper them.
We usually still start with metronidazole. If that fails, you go with the vanco. And then you're saying if that fails, go to the tapering.
Yeah, that's right. And you're also basing it on how sick the person is, right? So if they had very severe disease in the beginning and you managed to get them through it and now they're relapsing again, you know, you may become very aggressive very, very quickly. You know, you may get a surgical consultation, et cetera, as well.
So do you think we're going to come with a better definition of what is true Clostridium difficile infection with just having loose stool and a positive test? You mentioned if there's no white count, there's no abdominal pain. Because as we see more and more colonized patients come in, they get diarrhea. We test because you're supposed to do that first and then go into your culture and sensitivity. Is anyone working on a better definition than just diarrhea and positive test?
Well, certainly people are sort of revisiting the whole colonization thing again by actually screening asymptomatic patients. So, you know, I'm aware of a couple studies where people are doing that, looking to get a sense of, okay, we know you're colonized now, but you haven't got symptoms and we're not treating you, and what happens? And then if you develop symptoms, you know, then we'll jump on it. It's really because C. difficile is so much more complex than MRSA in a way, or even VRE for that matter, I think it's always going to be more murky. And some of these cases that we're inevitably calling nosocomial, you know, first of all, could actually be community because they could have picked it up from a pork chop 2 weeks ago. Or even if they caught it from you, are you entirely sure that they're actually sick with it? I think there's always going to be a bit of that ambiguity, and it makes it hard, especially now when you're publicly reporting. You could see how people could feel uncomfortable reporting things that they're not sure are actually real.
Yep. The infection control resource teams, what are you finding in terms of the FTE counts in hospitals for housekeeping? Are you coming into facilities where you find that it's just getting too low?
Yeah, we've seen a wide range. In the last couple of years, I would say in general, the housekeeping has been pretty good. We really haven't, you know, it's more sort of fine-tuning things where you're saying, you know, maybe you want to focus with sporicidal agents and that sort of thing, but the actual FTEs is pretty good. I would say 3, 4, 5 years ago, we were seeing a lot more of places that had dramatically cut housekeeping or had reorged housekeeping or something like that. So I think overall the housekeeping message is getting through to people. I think most hospitals are realizing that they're not office buildings and they can't think that they're going to have, you know, that low an FTE count. They're actually going to have to really staff up to be able to handle some of these things.
I'd like to thank you, Dr. Gardam, for the informative lecture, and I'd like to thank Virox Technologies for sponsoring this lecture. I'd like to thank everyone for listening in, and hopefully you will tune into future Weber training teleclasses. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Bye.